You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Our passage today is from Leviticus, a book that doesn't get a lot of love from Christians. Its reputation for being dry and pedantic is due, for the most part, from it being painfully dry and pedantic. The first 25 chapters are all about the nitty-gritty details of establishing sacred rituals and the laying down of laws that, in many cases, are hopelessly mired in ancient misinformation and no longer make any sense, except that bit about not sacrificing your children to Moloch. That still seems to be some pretty good advice. However, there are some gems in Leviticus, including one passage that, to this day, many Jews consider as the heart of the Torah, and that when asked what the greatest commandment was, Jesus himself quoted directly, "Love your neighbor as yourself." Right, like that's a thing.
Our words of wisdom are from Leviticus, chapter 19, verses 9 through 18, the Message version.
God spoke to Moses, "When you harvest your land, don't harvest right up to the edges of your field or gather the gleanings from the harvest. Don't strip your vineyard bare or go back and pick up the fallen grapes. Leave them for the poor and the foreigner. I am God, your God."
Don't steal, don't lie, don't deceive anyone. Don't swear falsely using my name, violating the name of your God. I am God. Don't exploit your friend or rob him.
Don't hold back the wages of a hired hand overnight. Don't curse the deaf. Don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. Fear your God. I am God.
Don't pervert justice. Don't show favoritism to either the poor or the great. Judge one on the basis of what is right. Don't spread gossip and rumors. Don't just stand by when your neighbor's life is in danger. I am God.
Don't secretly hate your neighbor. If you have something against him, get it out into the open. Otherwise, you are an accomplice in his guilt. Don't seek revenge or carry a grudge against any of your people. Love your neighbor as yourself. I am God.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
One day, Mullah Nasruddin was passing through the city gates, and a stranger stopped him and said, "Excuse me, what is Baghdad really like? I have to move, and I'm worried about living in the city." Nasruddin replied, "Tell me about the place you're coming from." "Oh, it was a wonderful place that I hate to leave. Neighbors were kind to one another. We looked out for the children. People shared and were generous and happy." Said Nasruddin, "You will love Baghdad. Don't worry at all. And welcome." Later, another stranger stopped the mullah at the city gates. "Excuse me, what is Baghdad really like? I have to move and I'm worried about living in the city." Nasruddin replied, "Well, tell me about the place you're coming from." "Oh, it's a terrible place. Can't get far enough away from it. Thieving and fornication and children noisy and running wild. People are selfish and distrustful." "Ah," said Nasruddin, "then you will really hate Baghdad. Best you move on to another city." Last week, we started our exploration of Shai Held's book, Judaism is About Love, with an overview of just how central love is in the Judaic tradition. This week, Rabbi Held dives into teasing out the implications of a command that is not only central to Judaism's understanding of love, but Christianity's as well. Love your neighbor as yourself. And it's no easy task. As you'd expect from a conscientious rabbi, Held wrestles with all the implications of what this command does and doesn't mean in what is clearly the longest, most tedious section of his book. He starts out with what seems like a common sense observation. You start with family and broaden the scope of your love from there. Only after he exhausts the challenges of loving one's spouse, children, and broader relations does he get to what loving the neighbor looks like. Interestingly, this whole argument was the center of attention just last week in the political news cycle. As Vice President Vance pontificated about the new administration's gutting the U.S. Agency for International Development, he tisked and said that any true Christian knows that you love your family, and then you love your neighbor, and then you love your community, and then you love your fellow citizens in your own country. Then, after that, you can focus and prioritize the rest of the world. Ah, the ignorance of a convert. What the newly minted Roman Catholic was referring to was what's called the Ordo Amoris, or the Order of Loves, which people like Augustine and Aquinas lay out as a guide for Christian behavior. And both say essentially just the opposite of what Vance claims. Of course, we love those closest to us most effectively, but for those who are really putting Jesus' vision to work, people who are at a great distance take priority. Universal love of all humanity is our priority. And as Augustine says, a rightly ordered love is one that doesn't ignore, but transcends personal relationships, extends beyond our immediate circles, and embraces all humanity. Sorry, JD, the work that USAID does is one of the most Jesus-y things the federal government does. Incidentally, Augustine lays out all of this in his book, The City of God. In Latin, its title is De Civitate Dei. You might recognize the initials DEI from the news. Isn't it ironic that while pompous Christian nationalists decry DEI as the work of the devil, in Latin, DEI is the genitive singular form of Deus, which literally means God. In other words, in Latin, DEI translates to of God. Yes, Margaret, DEI literally means of God. Sorry, Christian nationalists. As Rabbi Held explores the Jewish equivalent of the Ordo Amoris, he comes to essentially the same conclusion. While love as an emotion can't be turned on and off like a tap, emotions can be cultivated and developed. So he contends emotions can be commanded. We are commanded to respond with compassion to people who are poor. And more than that, as our Leviticus passage says today, we are to take direct action to support those who are downtrodden, like, for instance, leaving wheat and grapes in the fields for them to glean. In fact, Held contends that the Torah's command to care for the stranger is absolutely revolutionary in the development of ancient Middle Eastern thought. Jews are commanded not to just love our vulnerable, but to love the vulnerable, whether they are our own or not. Throughout Hebrew Scripture, it is repeated over and over again, "You shall not oppress a stranger, for you yourself were strangers in the land of Egypt." You know what it's like to be the vulnerable one. Then you've got this whole school of thought that says real love is what we shouldn't do. A classic Midrashic story tells of a Gentile who approaches Rabbi Hillel asking to be converted to Judaism on the condition that Hillel can teach him the entirety of the Torah while he stands on one foot. Hillel responds with what you might recognize as a version of the Golden Rule. That which is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. All the rest is commentary. Go and learn. Stated in the positive, Maimonides teaches, all the things you would want others to do for you, you do for your brother. Rabbi Held then launches into a frustratingly long debate over whether loving your neighbor means emotions or actions, only to end up concluding that it's, surprise, both, pointing out that it is usually a mistake in Judaism to ask if anything's an either-or question, because the answer is usually both and. And in this case, love expects both emotion and action. They are mutually reinforcing. A feeling of love leads us to act lovingly, and in turn, loving acts elicit or reinforce feelings of love, thus creating what he calls a virtuous circle. But to take it one step further, I turn to one of my Jewish mentors, Rabbi Rami Shapiro, who many of you know because I've preached on a number of his books. Rabbi Rami points out that a lot of people get our Leviticus passage wrong in the first place. They Oprah-fy it and misquote it as, love your neighbor as you love yourself. No! If loving yourself was a prerequisite to loving your neighbor, then most of our neighbors will be waiting a long time for love. Remember, the text actually says, love your neighbor as yourself. Not as you love yourself, as yourself. In other words, as though they are a part of you. Integrated, connected, and one with one another. This means all of our neighbors, without regard to race, color, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, or national origin. Granted, Rabbi Held finally gets around to the same point, but only after about 100 pages of eliminating every conceivable argument to the contrary. Human solidarity is rooted, ultimately, in a refusal to see individuals as fundamentally separate, atomized, responsible only to and for ourselves. A diminishment of you also diminishes me. It is knowing as deeply as we can know anything that we are interdependent and responsible for one another. Martin Luther King Jr. said, as long as there is poverty in the world, I can never be rich. Even if I have $1 billion, as long as diseases are rampant and billions of people in this world cannot expect to live more than 28 or 30 years, I can never be totally healthy. Even if I just got a good checkup at Mayo Clinic, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. This is the way our world is made. No individual or nation can stand out boasting of being independent. We are interdependent. When we look around the world, there are staggering numbers of people eking out their survival on less than a couple of dollars a day. Children are starving. Clean water is a luxury, and hundreds of thousands of children die every year because of poor sanitation. If we mean it when we say that all human beings are created in God's image, that each and every one of us has divinely bestowed dignity and ought to be able to live accordingly, then the call to love our neighbor, especially the stranger and our enemy, cannot but call us to action. And Jews get a bad rap on this whole love your enemies command. In Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, you should love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." The problem is, nowhere does the Hebrew Bible instruct Jews to hate their enemies. In fact, as we've already seen, Leviticus admonishes Jews about hating people. So chalk it up to early propaganda, and Matthew doing his part to try and make Jews look bad by putting these words in Jesus' mouth. Look, we are living in a time when the insistence to love our neighbor feels like a sentimental relic of the past. When politicians rile up their supporters with cries of fight, 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 we can be tempted to look for ways to exempt ourselves from the whole enterprise. And yet, the authors of Hebrew Scripture and Jesus himself lived in just as stressful of times. Over and over again, in commandments and parables, there is one consistent message. Don't figure out a way to redefine neighbor to only those who agree with you. Instead, figure out how to love all of humanity. And it's the work of a lifetime. The message to love your neighbor as yourself, including the stranger and your enemy, is one of the most transformational expectations any faith can have on us human beings. When Robert Frost said, "Good fences make good neighbors," it may ring true and be obviously practical, but when has the Torah and Jesus ever been accused of being practical? Loving our enemies, abandoning vengeance as an option, refusing to indulge in schadenfreude, and prioritizing the needs of the stranger among us are nothing if not impractical. Especially in light of the reality of the Hamas attacks of October 7th and the subsequent retaliation by Israel on the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip, this expectation becomes even more provocative. As Rabbi Held asks, "If a violent enemy enters my home with malice in mind, am I really supposed to offer him a sandwich? Is that reckless naivete?" To me, the clear answer from both the Torah and Jesus is yet another question. What if you did? Clearly, given free rein, hatred can totally overtake us. So what if we flew in the face of our basest human instincts and refused to respond with anything other than love? What would it look like? What affect would it have? Do we have the faithful imagination to consider the possibilities? As Rabbi Held points out, if human beings, even awful, murderous ones, are created in God's image, then perhaps we are forbidden, for religious reasons, from hating them. If we love God, we cannot hate what God has made. Hate sinners? No. You can hate the evil they do, but you have to love the person. Hate anti-Semites? Nope. Rabbi Levenstein says, if we allow ourselves to hate evildoers, we will implant hatred deep within ourselves, which will prevent us from attaining the virtue of loving people, which is one of the foundations of the Torah. As one Israeli rabbi says, we must make hatred itself hated as the height of all ugliness. The highlight of this whole section for me was Rabbi Held's nod to something that I think needs to be more of a focus for all of us. When considering what loving our neighbor looks like, the Torah, Jesus, and countless other world religions all turn to a variation of the Golden Rule. Either do unto others as you would have them do unto you, or don't do to others what you don't want done to yourself. The problem is, either way, it's all about you and your expectations. How do we get over ourselves? Instead of operating in a way that focuses on your priorities and your values, instead, try doing unto others as they would have you do unto them. And how do you know how they would have you do unto them? You ask them. It assumes the need for a conversation, and perhaps, if you're lucky, a relationship. Some of you in the business world will have heard this before. It's called the Platinum Rule. And yeah, that's because it's better than the stuffy old Golden Rule. It's not just love your neighbor, it's love your neighbor the way they want to be loved, not just the way you want to be loved. Who knows? If each of us took on the obligation to have the kind of conversations about values and identity that lead to genuine relationships, maybe we could start rebuilding trust with one another. And when we are committed to loving our neighbor as ourselves and actively building trust, we are investing in the kind of social capital that, dare I say it, changes the world. Can we go against our gut feelings, our superficial prejudices, and make the conscious decision to do the hard work of love, of trust, of building relationships that are transformational, even with strangers, especially with our enemies? What is your world like? Are neighbors kind to one another? Do they look out for the children and share with one another? Or are your neighbors thieving and untrustworthy strangers with noisy children running wild? Your answer might just reveal whether you're part of the solution or part of the problem. Be well. Don't forget, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a coffee. The link's in the description.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.